Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Candidates, open your accounts. The 2012 election campaign season begins.
And so there's a battle going on, local, state, federal level. I need conservatives, not just talk like conservatives. I need them to walk and act like conservatives.
Small business groups say the governor's reemployment and economic development bills will help grow jobs in the state.
When we do anything to reduce their costs that government imposes on them, that increases their willingness to take that chance and go out and expand.
Pressure mounts for the governor to veto a bill that reduces contributions to public employee retirement accounts. And the media faces backlash for misleading and sometimes inaccurate coverage in the Trayvon Martin case. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The legislature's revised Senate redistricting map is in the hands of the Florida Supreme Court justices. The court set oral arguments for April 20th to decide the plan's fate. However, James Call reports candidates are not waiting for the final decision on new district lines and have begun campaigning for the 2012 elections.
Moments after a Senate committee approved a new district map, senators gathered around it to see what it meant to their re-election chances.
I think I'm 36. I got the same.
You got 33.
33? This is me now?
Yeah. If that's your district,
yeah.
There was little change in Broward County Senator Eleanor Sobel's district, and the odd number for the Senate seat means she won't have to run for re-election in 2 years.
33.
You got four more years.
I'm happy.
Redistricting is the once-a-decade task of redrawing the political map for state House and congressional seats to reflect changes in population. This year, it is forcing several politicians to stand for re-election in front of new people. Second District Republican Congressman Steve Sutherland will have a more Democratic constituency under the plan. His district lines move east, taking in all predominantly Democratic Leon County, the most populated county in the redesigned district.
And so there's a battle going on, local, state, federal level. I need conservatives, not just talk like conservatives. I need them to walk and act like conservatives.
Leon Republicans filled up a country club banquet room to hear Sutherland speak at a midweek luncheon. The parking lot was filled and staff set up extra tables and chairs. More than 100 people watched Sutherland fire what may have been North Florida Republicans' opening salvo in the 2012 campaign.
It's real clear in November we've got to win elections. And we've got to win elections at all levels. We've got to win elections at the local level, the state level, the federal level. And I'm going to upset some people probably with this comment. One thing I've learned about our party, there, in some areas, there's probably some wolves in sheep's clothing. I certainly know that I'm among wolves in sheep's clothing in the Republican Conference in Washington, D.C. There's some people that need to go home. They need to go home.
At the state level, redistricting may send more than a few lawmakers home to stay. The new map for the House draws 33 representatives into competition with other incumbents. At least 10 have decided to run for a Senate seat, and 10 others will seek an open seat or run for a local office. Moments after the House passed the new Senate map, Democratic House Minority Leader Ron Saunders was discussing making an announcement for a Senate run.
Next week.
Next week?
I wanted to get through the session and all that, and I'm going to close out my House account and file for the Senate next week. I didn't want to do anything while we're still in session.
All right.
I'm going to be running against Dwight Bullard. Well, actually, it's him and James Bush are running. They've already filed.
Okay.
So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Across the rotunda, Pasco County Republican Senator Mike Fasano, whose protests have stymied Republican efforts to change insurance regulations and privatize state prisons, was setting his eyes on a return to the House. There was speculation Fasano would run for Congress, but the redistricting plan would have forced him to challenge an incumbent, Gus Bilirakis, who Fasano calls a friend. Instead, Fasano will try to take a step back to the Florida House, where he began his legislative career 18 years ago.
Absolutely not. I don't look at that as a you know, a second choice, but the ability to continue to serve in some capacity for the people of Pasco County.
The redistricting of Florida's political map is in the final stages, though there is still a chance changes can be made to the maps. The Supreme Court has 30 days to accept, reject, or replace the Senate proposal. The U.S. Justice Department also has to review the maps for compliance with the Voting Rights Act. Potential candidates hope all can be worked out in less than 8 weeks so they can know which office they are eligible to represent. The week-long candidate qualifying period for the November election begins June 4th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Florida Governor Rick Scott is traveling the state to promote a number of bills he signed that are part of the Reemployment and Economic Growth Package. But Regan McCarthy reports some experts question whether the governor's policies will help Floridians get back to work.
Florida Governor Rick Scott has held a total of 6 bill signings so far for a group of bills that will give tax breaks to the state's businesses and rebrand the unemployment program to be a reemployment program. In a weekly radio address, Scott said the move will make Florida an even more attractive state for businesses.
To help create jobs in our state, we have enacted measures to eliminate burdensome state rules and regulations.
But will the proposals help create jobs? The measures Scott signed would make changes like bumping up the state's corporate income tax exemption from $25,000 to $50,000 and give sales tax exemptions to certain industries like giving packing plants an exemption on the electricity they use. Their changes Florida's National Federation of Independent Businesses Executive Director Bill Hurley says will unquestionably help businesses.
When we do anything to reduce their costs that government imposes on them, that increases their willingness to take that chance and go out and expand.
Hurley says his members are also excited about a measure that, if approved by 60% of the voters in a referendum vote, would amend the state's constitution to double the tangible personal property tax exemption for businesses. Jim Cherry owns Cherry Communications in Tallahassee. He has a small office with a handful of permanent employees and a big pool of 50 to more than 100 temporary workers, depending on his current job. Cherry's business is conducting over-the-phone surveys, generally about political issues. He says for him, an increase in the state's tangible personal property tax exemption would definitely be a help.
One of the unfair things I've always thought is that if a business person has cash, they can take a trip to Hawaii, they can buy art for their home, and it's not taxable. Yet if you do something positive to create jobs, you know, buy more equipment so you can hire an extra person or two or upgrade your business or increase your productivity, you're actually taxed for that.
Cherry says he looks forward to using any savings for upgrading and buying more phone equipment, but he can't say for sure that he plans to create new jobs. And Hurley says it's hard to show an example of a business that gets lower taxes and, as a result, adds a job. But he says it's happening. For example, a survey put out by the Florida Chamber of Commerce shows 37% of the small businesses it surveyed plan to hire new employees during the next 6 months. That's up from 30% in July of 2011. But on the other hand, Robert Lynch, who chairs the Department of Economics at Washington College and authored the book Rethinking Growth Strategies: How State and Local Taxes Affect Economic Development, says cutting business taxes doesn't generally lead to growth. He says most studies are fairly unanimous in finding that reducing taxes on businesses has a very small impact on economic growth. Sometimes that impact is positive, but Lynch says often it's actually negative.
People don't realize what a small part of total business costs state and local taxes are. For the typical firm in Florida, of their total cost of doing business, the taxes, the state and local taxes they pay typically amount to a little bit over 1% of their total costs. You know, if you cut business taxes 20% or 25%, you're reducing the cost of business by 0.2 or 0.25%, leaving intact the other 99.75 or 99.8% of costs.
Lynch says that's not really a big enough percentage for a business to make a main consideration when making an investment decision.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland did a big analysis of all manufacturing relocations in the United States between 1972 and 1992, and they found that the states with the most generous business tax incentives had no more relocations than the states with the fewest business tax incentives. So the idea that businesses move to a state in response to various incentives is grossly exaggerated. There really isn't any strong evidence to support that.
Lynch says there is strong evidence to show that often businesses move because of the needs of executives who are looking for things like good school systems, low crime rates, recreation facilities, museums, and other quality of life considerations. And he says cutting business taxes means the government has less money to provide those kinds of services. But reducing business taxes in an effort to grow jobs is not just a Florida trend, but a trend that can be seen just about nationwide. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, opponents are calling for the governor to veto a bill that would allow state employers to reduce the amount they pay into their employees' retirement plans.
I think you'd have to be a fool to stay in a defined contribution plan because 3% is nothing. They could probably get better benefits at McDonald's or someplace. That's just ridiculous.
Some say it's too soon for the federal government to allow more drilling in the Gulf, this time about 100 miles south of Pensacola.
That perception literally scared people away. So these leases are closer by nautical miles than the Mikado well was when the Deepwater Horizon rig blew up.
Several media outlets are being criticized for misleading and inaccurate coverage of the Trayvon Martin case.
We're not here to try anybody in the streets or through the press or anything like that. The truth will come out.
And Florida's public school lunchrooms are putting more healthy foods on the menu. About a sixth of Florida state employees could see another retirement plan change. As Sasha Cordner reports, a bill is now on the governor's desk that would allow employers to contribute less into their employees' retirement accounts.
Currently, there are about 650,000 people enrolled within the Florida retirement system. That includes state employees, teachers, law enforcement officers, and city and county government workers. Most are enrolled in the state's pension plan known as the Defined Benefit Plan. The rest of the about 100,000 employees are enrolled in a 401k-type plan known as the Defined Contribution Plan or the Investment Plan. Last year, the legislature made significant changes to the state's retirement system by requiring all employees contribute 3% of their pay towards their retirement, regardless of the plan they're in. Now, those in the investment plan who were already contributing towards their retirement before the 2011 change could soon see another change that will further impact them. Because this year, the legislature voted to reduce the state employer's contributions to those only enrolled in the investment plan.
I think you'd have to be a fool to stay in a defined contribution plan because 3% is nothing. I think you could probably get better benefits at McDonald's or someplace. That's just ridiculous.
Howard Moyes is the Deputy Director for Property Tax Oversight at the Florida Department of Revenue. The 43-year-old has been a state employee for about 9 years. He's one of many who've been urging Governor Rick Scott to veto House Bill 5005. Moyes, who's currently enrolled in the investment plan, says he couldn't believe when his colleagues told him about all the changes in the bill. But Moyes later found out they were correct and says he's looking at a 65% reduction in retirement benefits.
With the changes last year, the contribution went from 9% to 6% effective July 1st, 2011. And now with this bill, the 6% would go down to 3.3%.
Other employees, depending on their profession, would also see lower employer contributions. Moyes says there's really not that many options now left for state employees like himself if this change goes into effect.
One, you don't change anything. You stay in the plan and you let the state contribute 3% and you either retire in poverty or don't retire at all. And the second option is you take your own money out of your paycheck and put it into a retirement account and save up additional funds that way. Or your third option is to go into the pension plan.
Another state employee who might be looking into the third option of switching retirement plans is 30-year-old Ray Walls. He's an Orange County employee with a wife and two kids. He says as a conservative, he's all for trimming government and finding efficiencies, but he fears this will take his retirement plans and those of tens of thousands of other young employees and throw them out the window. He says it could make state employment less desirable.
By doing things like this, it makes these jobs less appealing to people who have higher levels of skills, higher education, and that really want to be here and serve the people of Florida and their counties and cities. So I think that has a very big detrimental impact on being able to get good people.
Wall says the legislature can't keep shortchanging state employees, something that Republican Senator Mike Fasano agrees with. The Newport Richey lawmaker was one of two senators who voted against the bill. Fasano says Senate Budget Chief J.D. Alexander was pushing the measure without fully explaining it.
To me, that's very deceitful. When a major component is in a bill that will have that much impact on the workers of our state here in the state of Florida, that should have been made very clear before the member asked for the senators to vote on the bill.
Most Democrats in the Senate voted in favor of House Bill 5005, including State Senator Bill Montford of Tallahassee. He agrees that state employees have had the short end of the stick for a while, especially with the 3% contribution. However, he says he voted for the bill because he wanted to be fair.
This particular House bill equalized the participation rate from the state. In other words, 3% regardless of the choice. I believe that the state has an obligation to treat its employees fairly and equitably. And to me, it was an issue of equity, regardless of the plan a state employee would choose.
Montford says several state employees have contacted him about the bill, and he says some new information has come to his attention, which he's currently investigating. He declined to comment on that new information at this time, but he says he does intend to revisit the issue. The president of the United Faculty of Florida's Florida Atlantic University chapter, Chris Robay, says the bill is premature because it hinges on the Florida Supreme Court deciding in favor of the 3% contribution. And he adds there may be another legal challenge brought forth if House Bill 5005 is signed by the governor. Governor Rick Scott has until April 21st to decide whether to sign the bill into law. If the bill is signed, it will go into effect July 1st of this year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
The death of a black teen at the hands of a neighborhood watchman has caught the attention of the nation, dominated media headlines, and put a spotlight on Florida's gun laws. But Lynn Hatter reports, in the week since the death of Trayvon Martin, the focus on the circumstances surrounding the teen's death has also created backlash against the media for misleading and sometimes inaccurate coverage.
NBC has been criticized for the way it edited 911 calls that portrayed the alleged shooter, George Zimmerman, as racially insensitive. Here's the original audio tape.
This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something. It's raining and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
And here is the NBC version of what was said.
This guy looks like he's up to no good. He looks black.
What's missing from the NBC version is context. Also under criticism is ABC for comments made about the surveillance footage of Zimmerman at the Sanford Police Department shortly after the shooting. The commentators said Zimmerman appeared to be uninjured. And then there's the issue of the pictures. For Zimmerman, it's a mugshot photo. For Trayvon Martin, a photo of him as a younger kid. Both not true representations of the people as they would appear today.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
Rallies like this one in Tallahassee on the 44th anniversary of the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. have occurred across the country in the wake of Martin's death. He was killed in the Central Florida community of Sanford following an altercation with neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman, who's Hispanic. Zimmerman says he shot Martin in self-defense and hasn't been charged with a crime. Differing versions of what happened continue to unfold, and some people, like Tallahassee Mayor John Marks, are calling for restraint and to let the judicial process run its course.
We must ensure that the court system operates appropriately for everybody under these circumstances. We're not here to try anybody in the streets or through the press or anything like that. We just want the justice system to work as it should.
That pointed remark about trying people in the press is part of a bigger issue.
Those are very specific instances involving very specific news organizations. And I don't think that most people generalize to all media based on the actions of a single news organization. In the work that I've done on this specific case, I'm not seeing people criticize the media overall.
Kelly McBride is with the Poynter Institute for Media Studies and is tracking the effects of the coverage of the Trayvon Martin case and the role of commentators in spreading accurate and inaccurate information.
And you may ask, do commentators more often create distortions or inaccurate impressions of a particular case? And in this case, I think the commentators are definitely speaking to a specific audience, a subset, but I don't think that they have been more responsible for inaccuracies than anyone else.
Other outlets have come under fire for the way they've portrayed Trayvon Martin, with reports that he was suspended from school for marijuana residue found in his book bag. There are also allegations that it was Martin who threw the first punch in the run-up to his shooting, something that the alleged shooter, George Zimmerman, has maintained in his self-defense claim. Meanwhile, state and federal law enforcement agencies are still investigating how Martin ended up dead while walking home with an iced tea and a bag of Skittles. The true details of the investigation won't be revealed until those investigations are finished. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Is Florida ready to entertain the idea of drilling for oil near its shores? The federal government seems to think so. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is considering oil drilling leases in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and some local businesses along the Florida Panhandle say now is not the time.
We were heavily impacted by the BP spill, and we still are being impacted by that. So knowing that, we don't want this in our backyard. We don't see that it is a safe, you know, thing to do.
Pam Anderson of Captain Anderson's Marina in Panama City harkens back to just 2 years ago when the world watched as oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico following the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, which killed 11 people. She's airing her concerns to three members of the Bureau of Ocean Energy. The agency held a series of hearings making stops in Tallahassee and Panama City to get public comments on the potential drilling for oil about 125 miles south of Pensacola. Only a few people showed up to air their concerns. Here is Panama City local John Dunaway.
While we were not impacted immediately, our tourism industry was greatly damaged by just the perception. These are much closer, actually, to us, a lot closer than the well that created problems for us in 2010, both real and the perception.
The agency is proposing the sale of two leases in what's called the Eastern Planning Area, which looks triangular on a map and encompasses about 657,000 acres and could be developed for oil extraction as well as natural gas exploration. But Gary Gokey with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in New Orleans says moving forward on the plan depends on the input from the communities.
The next step after we finish this series of meetings will be to go back to our office, gather up all of this information, gather up all of the latest scientific information that we can pull together, and write an environmental document that fully discloses all the potential impacts. And once that draft document is published, then we will do this again, where everybody can come out to our public hearings and they can have, having read and reviewed the document, then they can give us their thoughts and their comments.
And all comments are welcomed by visiting BOEM.gov. Finally, in the past, public school lunchrooms haven't always been known for serving tasty food that's also healthy food. But Tom Flanagan reports there's a major move in Florida to serve students good-tasting meals that are also good for them.
Springwood Elementary School looks a little bit like a set from the Food Network. Various yummy menu ingredients are stacked on a table. Some students are talking about their most and least favorite foods.
And then when it was done...
But the kids aren't just talking about food, they're also learning about food, such as what kinds of food are the best for you, and even how to prepare simple healthy snacks. This comes courtesy of Chef Justin Timonetti, who works for the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services.
Today we're starting a new program for younger children, first, second, and third grade. So it's great to be here working with the younger children.
These are all skills and information the kids can take home with them. But for many children, the meals they're served at school make up a significant part of their overall diet. That fact has prompted some lunchroom changes.
You know, we've had several changes as far as our menus and nutrition, but I think there's definitely a move toward making sure that what students are exposed to is healthy and that they have healthy choices. When you go in the lunchroom, you'll see there's always a salad available, and the students like that. And we have a huge number of students that will opt for the salad lunch. So I think it's making a difference.
The first big difference wasn't really about food, at least not at first. It was the transfer of responsibility for Florida's public school lunchrooms.
Last session, the legislature passed and moved all the child nutrition programs from the Department of Education to the Department of Agriculture, which is the National School Lunch Program and the Summer Feeding Program and the Breakfast Program. And we're like one of only three states where those child nutrition programs are at the Department of Ag.
Robin Safley is in charge of those programs for the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. She says the transfer of authority came at the same time Washington was issuing new directives for in-school nutrition.
The new meal pattern came down from the federal government, which requires an emphasis on fruits and vegetables in the school lunch program. So we think that we're in a pretty exciting position to marry up our farmers and our local growers with the school system so that we can ensure the freshest of produce is available.
How can schools persuade kids, some of whom have never tasted fresh produce, to give it a try? Safley says many schools now have their own vegetable gardens as a multi-level learning tool.
Kids who are exposed to it, who get attached to it, understand where it comes from, understand the whole farming mechanism and the agriculture piece of it, get their hands dirty a little bit, understand, you know, plant the seed, it grows, they water it, then they get to harvest it, and then they get to taste it, they are more apt to try it.
So how is all this working in the real world of the public school lunchroom? Leon County School Superintendent Jackie Pons has been talking with his colleagues around the state. He says hopes are running high.
I think it's going to be a good thing. I think everybody has to be patient because they're trying to do is to make sure that we use more of our Florida-grown fresh produce in our schools. So I think it's going to be a very positive thing. They're moving these initiatives forward, but it's a little too early now to have them started. It's in the beginning stages, but it's going to be great for our state, and I think it's a step in the right direction.
A good direction for a state in which the childhood obesity rate is around 30% and type 2 diabetes is showing up in grade school kids. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tremel Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.